You are listening to The State of Sustainability, a podcast that highlights sustainability initiatives throughout the state and develops a casual conversation about environmental stewardship that the average person can understand and replicate. I'm your host, Caleb Powell.
And I'm your co-host, Ashley Cabrera.
So today on the pod, we are going to be talking about electric vehicles, or how we a lot of times will mention them. We say EVs. So if you hear us throughout the podcast today, say the word EV or EVs, we're talking about electric vehicles. So I don't know if you guys have noticed, but the use of EVs and the expansion of charging stations in our state has grown tremendously over the past year, 2 years really. And so today, with the help of our guest, Mark Finley, we are going to talk about the growth and really just tell you some ways that you can participate in, you know, being a part of the EV world, you know, whether it is owning one or, you know, like I said, I'll leave a lot of that up to Mark to tell us a little bit more of, you know, how you can participate in the ever-growing EV landscape that is in Tennessee.
Yeah, and we even have several, I think maybe half of our Tennessee state parks who now have EV charging stations. So we're going to highlight those as well on this episode, so stay tuned.
So today I would like to introduce a good friend of mine and our very intelligent guest on the podcast today. We have Mark Finley. He is TDEC Senior Energy Analyst for our Office of Energy Program. So Mark, how are you doing today?
Doing great.
We're super excited to have you on the podcast. Every time I get to talk to you in the office, or you know, when we're planning the Sustainable Transportation Forum and Expo, it's always super enlightening getting to talk to you about all the different things you do for our Office of Energy Program. So excited to have you on the podcast. And how we normally like to start this is, you know, I want you to sort of give your history or how you got where you are, and sort of how you gained your knowledge. So feel free to just talk about yourself for a little bit and let us know how you got here.
Yeah, absolutely. So I've been working with the state for about 4 years now, a little over 4 years. Been in with the Office of Energy Programs the whole time. And my primary focus is really working on different initiatives, different funding programs, things like that, as it pertains to energy and transportation. I'd say that's probably about a solid 3/4 of my work. We work on a number of other different energy initiatives relating to solar energy, natural gas, et cetera. But my primary focus is on alternative fuels and other sustainable transportation, topics. I kind of came up with an interest in sustainable energy. I ended up being an intern for a Clean Cities Coalition up in New York, where I went to school. And that's kind of how I transitioned into my current position, as that was kind of focused on alternative fuels promotion and things like that. So really my main focus is on a lot of the state's programs, mainly right now to push vehicle electrification and the associated infrastructure.
Yeah, so it's, absolutely perfect, excuse me, in my opinion, to have you on this episode where we're talking about EVs in Tennessee and sort of like the status update of where we're at. So I'll go ahead and jump right into it. I wanted to ask, how have you seen EVs grow in Tennessee over the past 3 to 5 years? So, you know, essentially, since you've been with the state, with TDEC, how have you seen that growth specifically in our state?
I mean, the boom has been enormous, to be quite honest. We're in a completely different place right now than we were back in 2019. One thing that we keep track of on a quarterly basis is the number of, EV registrations that we have in the state. So that was at about 7,000 registered EVs on Tennessee roads in late 2019 when we first started tracking that. And now, as of the most recent quarter, so as of the end of June, we just passed 30,000 in the state. And so, you were talking over 4 times as many EVs in Tennessee as there were just 4 years ago, less than 4 years ago. So we're seeing that growth in the light duty sector. We're seeing medium and heavy duty sector take over. More and more transit agencies around the state are beginning to electrify in Memphis, Chattanooga, Knoxville. There are several organizations around the state that are starting to electrify their fleets, like the Upper Cumberland Human Resource Agency, Vanderbilt University, have recently deployed electric shuttle fleets. And then we're also seeing school districts begin to electrify their fleets as well. The first electric school bus in Tennessee in 2021 in Washington County. And then over the last couple of years, we've been seeing states or school districts receive money from the Environmental Protection Agency to purchase more electric buses, with the next couple arriving in Bledsoe County earlier this year. And we're just also seeing big build-outs of infrastructure around the state. That's both through state, federal funding, as well as funding from utilities as well. So both level two and fast charging infrastructure is going around throughout the state, and all, and, you know, not just in our metro areas, not just along the interstates, but we're seeing it more in the rural areas as well to serve those folks.
Wow, those numbers, I had no idea. I had no idea that the growth was that substantial. That's, I appreciate you bringing those metrics in here, because I think that really puts it into perspective with the growth of electric vehicles here in our state.
Yeah, absolutely. And you know, we're not just talking about, you know, Tennessee really wants to be a leader in the South for electric vehicles, not just for deployment of infrastructure, not just for the promotion of you know, fleets that utilize EVs, but also even in manufacturing. For example, there have been billions of dollars of investment in the state from EV and battery manufacturers over the last couple of years, really since the passage of the Infrastructure Investment and Jobs Act a couple of years ago. And it's really causing Tennessee to be a leader, not just in the South, but nationwide for manufacturing. One cool little tidbit is that once all of those manufacturing operations go live over the next couple of years, Tennessee will be just the second state other than Michigan, which is historically auto manufacturer leader. It'll be the second state to have four different producers of electric vehicles in the state. So it's really exciting. You know, it's not just helping with the environment, but we're also spurning the local economy as well. That's always a good thing.
And you know, with the growth and everything, I know that, and this may be true for many of our listeners, myself included, thinking about, you know, wanting to contribute and get an electric vehicle. But realistically, I think some may think that they can't participate in, you know, this EV growth and movement because of the costs. So can you shine some light on the realistic cost of EVs, and maybe if there are any things in place that can help Tennesseans get past that?
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, that's always one of the biggest things, one of the biggest challenges that we face historically with EVs has been the, you know, the upfront capital costs to invest. Thankfully, as we're seeing technology advance, as we're seeing adoption, you know, allowing operations to scale up, we are seeing the prices of vehicles coming down. Affordable options are becoming more prevalent. As EVs have been on the road for longer, we're starting to see them break into the used market a lot more. Whereas a few years ago, you know, it was kind of a difficult, you know, a difficult process to try and get a used EV. Now we're seeing more and more of those on the road. There's actually a couple of used car resellers that specialize in electric vehicles at this point. So that market is continuing to grow. But just in terms of kind of the realities of owning an EV and kind of what you can do to bring those costs down, you know, let's first talk about cost of ownership. You have the cost of charging versus the cost of, you know, conventional gasoline or diesel. You know, if you're talking current gas prices, $3.50 a gallon versus the average price per kilowatt of electricity in Tennessee, you're talking a comparison between about $1,500 per year on fuel with gasoline versus $300 a year on fuel for electric vehicles. And that's assuming that most of the charging is done at home, which is the case for most people. The maintenance costs are lower. There's way few moving parts. And so you're not going to need to go in for oil changes. You're not going to have to worry about engine problems because there's no, you know, conventional engine in an all-electric vehicle. So you're talking about maybe 6 cents per mile maintenance costs for a gasoline vehicle, while some electric vehicles can be as low as 1 to 2 cents. So that saves quite a bit of money over the lifetime of the car. And then finally, especially with recent federal legislation that's been passed, we've had some expansions to the available tax credits and incentives that are available for consumers. So the vast majority of electric vehicles that are on the market right now are eligible for a tax credit of up to $7,500. And so that can really help close the gap and maybe even close the gap entirely between an affordable EV and a similarly compared gas vehicle. So that tax credit can really go a long way in helping with those upfront costs. And then over the lifetime of the vehicle, you're talking fuel and maintenance, it's going to be substantially lower cost than a gas vehicle.
Yeah, so, you know, you touched on the charging cost, which I didn't realize that it was that drastic. You know, and I know those are probably just like sort of averages and stuff like that, but that's pretty drastic, you know, from a year's worth of gasoline and then a year's worth of essentially charging at home. But I wanted to talk about when you're not at home. So like essentially charging stations. Here in the state, I know you guys worked quite a bit on sort of a roadmap of charging stations. Could you touch on like how many charging stations we currently have across the state? And then like what are the different levels and really what do they mean?
Yeah, absolutely. So in terms of a snapshot of what we've got across the state, we've got about 70 fast charging locations, plus an additional 24 locations that are Tesla locations around the state. So combined, you know, we're approaching 100 total fast charging locations. They vary in power level. Some of these are a little bit lower powered, you know, 25 to 30 kilowatt chargers. But some of these sites are equipped with higher powered, you know, up to 350 kilowatt chargers. Just for context, a 350 kilowatt charger, you can typically expect that to add about 200 miles of range to a battery in about 10 to 15 minutes. So pretty high powered stuff. And that's kind of the type of infrastructure that we're seeing go more into the ground with recent investments. These stations will have three different kinds of plugs. The most common is the combined charging system, or the CCS. That's the most commonly used by non-Tesla vehicles at the moment. There's also the Chatomo port, which is currently predominantly used by Nissan vehicles, although Nissan may have plans to phase that out moving forward. And then there's the North American Charging Standard, or NACS, which as of right now is only utilized by Tesla vehicles, but other auto and charging manufacturers have recently announced that they'll begin to adopt that moving forward. So there's a little bit of movement there. We're kind of moving towards a situation, I think, where NACS is going to become kind of the predominant charging port for these fast chargers. In terms of level two chargers, you know, this is where you're not going to sit and wait for the vehicle to charge. This is where it's going to take, you know, 2 to 3 hours to charge your vehicle. It's meant to, you know, you're meant to plug in while you're at a destination like a park or a shopping center, a restaurant, or if you're in like a parking garage, a workplace, a multifamily housing development, etc. There's about 600 publicly available sites around the state right now, and these are sprinkled, you know, throughout the entire state, not just in the metro areas, but you'll find these level two chargers in some of the rural, more small towns as well. You know, sites like the U.S. Department of Energy's Alternative Fuel Station Locator, or apps like PlugShare, can essentially allow folks to see where these stations are, and then even plan out trips to ensure that someone has enough juice to get from point A to point B on a road trip. And so I mentioned fast charging level two. So then obviously that implies that there's a level one, but level one really is just referring to what's done at home. So you take your car, plug it into a normal outlet, charge it overnight. This is also referred to as trickle charging. So it can take about 10 to 12 hours to fully charge on that. But that is the vast majority of what most drivers charge their vehicle with.
Thank you for explaining that, because when I was looking at the map of the different locations, I saw the different levels. I'm like, I have no clue what that means. And I have family members that have EVs, and so I've heard them talk about it. I just kind of listened. I didn't ask. So it's nice to know what the different levels are and what they mean. I do have a question. When you were mentioning that there's different kinds of like chargers, is it just like the brands and who made them? Because in my mind, I would think we would just go to just one type of plug or one type of charger. I wonder if there's a reason why.
Yeah, and that's sort of what we're moving towards. So I'll go over kind of a brief history. So really the first widely available EV on the market in the U.S. would be the Nissan Leaf. So that uses what is called a CHAdeMO port. This is a port that's not quite as capable as taking a charge as quickly, but it was kind of the earliest available technology at the time. Nissan Leafs continue to use this port, even the new ones sold today. While there was, with other manufacturers that were starting to roll out electric vehicles, they adopted the combined charging system, or CCS, which is capable of delivering a little bit faster of a charge. So it's a little bit more ideal for fast charging stations, for really getting up to that full 350 kilowatt power that I mentioned earlier. And then the NACS is, or the North American Charging Standard, that's what's been utilized by Tesla. Up until recently, that was a proprietary charger. And so Tesla has its own charging network. It had its own charging port that it used only on its vehicles, and no one else used it. But recently, they opened up that patent for the NACS for other manufacturers to utilize. And so we're seeing that there are a few manufacturers, Ford is among them, GM is another, that have committed to moving forward by, say, 2025, they will begin to equip their vehicles with that charging standard. So right now there's a little bit of uncertainty as to where things will go, whether it's the CCS or the NACS moving forward, or if there'll be some combination of the two. But we're starting to see that movement towards that North American charging standard, and that will also allow other vehicles to utilize Tesla stations, and it'll allow Tesla vehicles to utilize non-Tesla stations as well. So it's kind of a little bit of uncertainty, like I said, but it's overall kind of trending to a more uniform situation going forward. So we're not going to have as many situations where, can I even charge at that? Is that the port that my car needs? Yada, yada. So that'll continue to develop over the next couple of years, but that's kind of the movement we're seeing at the moment.
Thanks for explaining that, and that makes a lot of sense. So you just said it, having these different level chargers or different types of chargers, might be a roadblock to actually being able to charge, and how far can I even go? Something else going into that, thinking about this, is Tennessee has a lot of rural areas. So what are the plans to expand more into those rural areas? And I know we have all of our state parks across the state, and many of them already have charging stations. So if you can mention that as well, how that comes into play as far as expanding more into rural areas, so people don't find themselves pretty much in the middle of nowhere to charge.
Yeah, absolutely. I'll first kick it off by mentioning the state parks initiative. The auto manufacturer Rivian and the state entered into a partnership in 2021. And so this was to for Rivian to provide chargers free to use by the public at each state park in Tennessee, or at least all the ones where the, you know, the network was available, the electricity infrastructure was available, et cetera, which is the vast majority of them. These are level two chargers. The first one was installed at Radnor Lake in 2021, which is actually the very first Rivian charger to be installed in the United States. The most recent installation occurred at Cummins Falls just this past weekend. So that brings the total up to 26 state parks at the moment, with the remainder that are to be installed to be built out throughout the remainder of the year. But outside of that, you know, like I said before, level two charging, not really ideal for, you know, doing it in the middle of a trip. And so it's important that we get fast charging infrastructure out in those areas as well. And so one way that we're doing that is through the Fast Charge Tennessee Network program, which is a partnership between the state, between TDEC and TVA, Tennessee Valley Authority, to build out fast charging along all of Tennessee's what we call primary and secondary corridors. So primary corridors include all of the interstates, and then the secondary corridors include many of the state's major U.S. and state highways. And so many of these highways will run through quite rural areas, you know, small towns. And so we're building it out every 50 miles along those roadways. And so several of these have already gone in the ground here in Tennessee. The most recent just went live in Brownsville just in the last week or so. There's another that's going to be going live in Paris coming up soon. And then there's more down the pike with about, I think there's been here in Tennessee, somewhere around 10 that have gone live or are set to go live very soon. And then an additional 25 to 30 or so that are under contract and going to be built out throughout the remainder of the year and going into next year. So that's going to be siting a number of infrastructure locations throughout the state. And then there's also the National Electric Vehicle Infrastructure Program. The state actually just released its first notice of funding opportunity for this program. And what this is going to do is it's going to locate very highly powered fast chargers along designated what are called alternative fuel corridors, which currently includes all of the Tennessee interstates, as well as U.S. Route 64, going along the south side of the state. And so this will include a number of different sites on those interstates in the more rural areas. And then once those corridors are built out, we'll be able to use that money to fund more community sites in the future. You know, sites that aren't necessarily located by an interstate, but are more centrally located in a rural community or on one of those highways that span them. Another thing that I'll mention is that the state recently submitted a proposal for the Charging and Fueling Infrastructure Grant Program. This was a competitive grant program through the Federal Highway Administration, and our proposal included an entire component dedicated to rural fast and level two charging. So in the event that that gets funded, we're going to essentially be going out for proposals for folks to build out infrastructure specifically in rural areas and with that rural community component. And then finally, I'll just mention that we do have plans to release at least one level two charging rebate program in probably either later this year or early 2024 that will have a focus on level two destination charging. Level two rural destination charging specifically. And so the plans for that is to essentially see if our CFI, Charging and Fueling Infrastructure Grant Proposal, gets funded. And then if in the case that it does not, we will launch that rebate program to help assist the build out of additional level two charging at various destinations throughout the state. You know, we're talking about small town squares, you know, local parks, shopping centers, etc. So that'll be something that'll be coming down the pipeline shortly.
Wow, that's pretty incredible. And you know, as I was listening to you talk, Mark, I just thought, like, you know, a lot of these small town squares, like you mentioned, even if it is a level two, sort of like a, you know, a couple hours to charge, that might be a good opportunity to, for, you know, you to go visit some of these smaller communities and, you know, dump money into their economy and go eat at the little cafe or go check out the antique store, the little boutiques. And it might, you know, I feel like that this is going to be an opportunity to sort of bring more economic growth to these smaller rural communities.
Yeah, absolutely. And that's definitely one of the big focuses. You know, we want electric vehicle drivers that, you know, currently own in the state, as well as future owners, to feel like they can go visit these communities, that they won't be caught somewhere without any place to fill up. And then, like you said, it'll allow folks to visit these communities, to really draw in those drivers to, like you said, spend a couple hours, you know, eat at the restaurant nearby, check out a place that they might have not otherwise been able to. So that's certainly one of the big components, is all of this really ties back to not just promoting electric vehicle adoption, but also spurning economic growth and economic development for, you know, both for the state as a whole, but just also the communities within it.
Yeah, I think it's just a win-win all around. I'm super excited that Tennessee is sort of like, you know, the South's or the Southeast's, like, hub for, in my opinion, for EVs. I know we've got, like you said, we've got Nissan that's producing electric vehicles. We have GM in Spring Hill, not to mention the huge battery plant that they're building. I think that's called Ultium or Ulti. What's it called?
Yeah, I believe, yeah, it'd be Ultium cells, yeah.
And, I mean, we've just got a lot of auto manufacturers that are now, or, you know, in the near future are going to be producing EVs. So excited there. Mark, appreciate your time and appreciate all the work that you do here in the state, and especially more specifically for the Office of Energy Programs. I don't think I have any more questions for you. What we'll do is we'll make sure that a lot of the maps that we talked about, some of those apps that you mentioned that sort of maps out the charging stations and stuff like that, we'll make sure that we link that in the sort of caption of our post that goes with this episode, so that everyone has easy access to those apps and those different resources. But once again, Mark, thanks for your time, and yeah, we'll talk to you soon.
Yeah, absolutely. Thanks a lot, Caleb. I really appreciate you bringing me on. Thank you too, Ashley.
Thank you.
The Ranger Report, brought to you by the Tennessee State Parks. Fun and adventure, naturally. All right, we are back with our Ranger Reports after some time. This is by far one of my favorite parts of the podcast, getting to talk to our amazing rangers and staff at all of the state parks here in Tennessee. So today we are going to be highlighting Montgomery Bell State Park, and we have the great pleasure to have Destiny Adcox, a park ranger too, there at Montgomery Bell. So how you doing today, Destiny?
I'm good, how are y'all?
Doing great. We know that you've got a lot on your plate, so it means a lot that you've taken time to sit down and let us know about the park. I love Montgomery Bell. That's honestly one of my probably top five most visited parks. It's just there's so much to do there. So how we normally like to start these Ranger Reports is by getting to know you a little bit better. So I'm gonna throw it over to you. I already mentioned your name is Destiny Adcox. You are a ranger, park ranger at Montgomery Bell State Park. But can you sort of tell your past experiences and sort of how you got to where you are today?
Sure, so I went to the University of Tennessee at Martin, and I studied natural resource management. I thought I wanted to be a game warden, but when I was in school, TWRA did not have internships, but state parks did. So I started going that route. My first summer at parks was the summer of 2014. I went to my home park at Nathan Bedford Forest in Benton County. So I did two summers there. The third summer, I went to Rock Island, and Rock Island is where I absolutely fell in love with the job. So then after I graduated college, I started applying for ranger jobs. While I was waiting to get a full-time job, I went to work for the Central Office of State Parks in Nashville and traveled the whole state just offering support for big events and races and camps and things like that. I was hired full-time in 2018 at Timms Ford State Park. I did about 3 years there, and then I transferred here in November of 2021.
Wow. It's crazy. I love getting to hear the backstories from our rangers, because you guys really come from all walks of life, but then there's a very, what's the word I'm looking for? Like, there's a theme with sort of how you start. You know, you sort of dip your toes into either interning or, you know, just helping out at a park, and you fall in love with it. I mean, it's very easy to fall in love with our state parks, and so it's really cool seeing all the different parks that you've worked at, and then it's really cool that you did a small stint really just working for all the parks.
Yeah, I was there for just about a year. Well, it was just over a year before I transferred out, so it was a really good year building all sorts of skills and learning so many different things in so many different parks. And I think that's really what helped me a lot.
Oh, yeah, definitely. I mean, like, and that helps you really tell the full story of our state park system, right? I mean, like, knowing not just your one park, but multiple parks and helping out with all the different events and all the different, you know, volunteer opportunities and stuff like that. So, you know, just really proud to have you on the podcast today, and really thankful for all the work that you've done for state parks in your years working for them. I wanted to talk now about sort of the history of the park. So, you know, in this section, we like to talk about when Montgomery Bell became a state park, what the land was before that, and sort of how it became a state park. So could you dive into that for us?
Yeah, so Montgomery Bell became a state park in 1942. At that point, it had been kind of like the CCC was here building a park that they thought was going to be a national park, but it ended up getting turned over to the state. And prior to that, it was really just the whole area of Dixon County was bustling with the iron industry. So we had Laurel Furnace here on site. We don't have it anymore, but they dug in the ground, got out iron ore, and smelted it down to make cookware and things like that in the area. Montgomery Bell actually never was where Montgomery Bell State Park is, but he was the most well-known iron tycoon in the area at the time.
Awesome. And so when we're talking, and you sort of mentioned this a little bit, but when we're talking about actual park information, I always like to ask, and this question sometimes stumps some of the rangers, but when we're talking park size, if we put them into three categories, small, medium, large, where would you categorize Montgomery Bell in those three categories?
I would say we're on the large size of medium or the lower size of large, because we're just under 4,000 acres, which is a lot, but then you think you've got parks that have got a lot of forest land, and you have parks that can be 10,000 acres, but they may not use as much of it, so there's still a very large park. I feel like we're decently large, but we use a lot of our land, and we have a whole lot to offer, so for that reason, I'd say we're on the larger side of a medium-sized park.
Definitely. And so you mentioned what county you guys are in, but if somebody has never heard of Montgomery Bell State Park and they're looking at a map of Tennessee, can you sort of dumb down where you guys are located?
Yeah, we're just about 40 minutes west of Nashville. If you get on I-40, head west, just about 40, 45 minutes, here we are.
Close to Dixon, right? Or in Dixon County, right?
It's in Dixon County. We technically have a Burns address, but if you need to go to Walmart, you got to go to Dixon.
Good deal. So, you know, you mentioned this at the very beginning. You guys do a great job at using your large area with many different opportunities for the public to come and enjoy nature. So can you talk about the park activities that you guys offer?
Yeah, we've got a campground that has 94, I believe, different campsites. We've got them all the way from primitive with no electric, no water, to full hookup with your sewer. We've got several creeks. We have three different lakes that offer boating, fishing, things like that. We have a swim beach that's open seasonally, a golf course, a lodge, restaurant. We also have some cemeteries. We have the birthplace of the Cumberland Presbyterian Church. We have miles and miles of hiking trails. We also have mountain bike trails. And we also have a group lodge available for rent.
Yeah, that's a lot. I've been to Montgomeryville so many times. I think a few of those things I actually have not done. I think mainly the boating.
Another thing that I forgot is that we last year put in an archery range. So now we have an archery range that the public can come out. They don't have to pay anything for, and they can come practice archery.
That is really cool. Okay. Yeah, I definitely didn't know that part. I was going to say the last time I went hiking at Montgomeryville, and I'm glad you mentioned it, like some of the historical landmarks that are still there. Because I think the first time, and this was probably about 5-6 years ago, we were hiking and came across that church that you mentioned, which, what kind of state is it in? Is it just kind of, no? Can you go inside of it? I didn't know how well preserved it was.
So we don't own the church or the cabin replica. That is still owned by the Cumberland Presbyterian Church, but we have all the land surrounding it, and we do help maintain it. The Cumberland Presbyterian Church comes in a couple times a year, has a cleanup day, and then also in the summer months, from Memorial Day to Labor Day, they hold a church service in there on Sunday mornings. I don't think they rent it out anymore, but people go in it all the time. I find people in there playing the piano, playing the organ, singing, all those types of things, because it's open to the public.
Wow, okay. Next time I'm at Montgomeryville, I'm going to take a longer look at that.
It's beautiful. It has beautiful stained glass.
Yeah, you know, it's great how all of our parks have such a good mix of, you know, history and nature and animals and, you know, outdoor activities. And so, you know, one of my favorite things to do is golf, and I've actually played golf at Montgomeryville's golf course, and it's great. You know, since I've had my, I have a 5.5-month-old, so since she's been born, I haven't been able to play golf much, but I sort of wish that we would have done this interview.
Give it a year and a half, because I have an almost 3-year-old and he's obsessed with our golf course. Give it a year and a half,
okay.
And she'll want to be out there.
Okay, say less. That gets me really excited. So Destiny, what would you say if you had to pick one thing from the park that sort of sets you guys aside from other parks? Like what, in your mind, what makes Montgomeryville State Park so unique?
It's hard because every park is so unique for different reasons. Because we're obviously not the only park in the state with a campground or a lodge or a golf course even.
Maybe that would be a cool way of saying it. Like, what is your favorite part of the park?
My favorite part of the park is back on our North Loop Trail. It crosses over a creek. And it's just far enough out that a lot of people, like, people still hike it, but it just really feels untouched. And the creek is kind of like slab rock and not normal kind of river pebbles. And it's just really pretty back there.
See,
I also really love birding, and we have a lot of pileated woodpeckers, so I nerd out on that a little bit.
I love that. That's something that, you know, I've never really been too big on birding. And I mean, I enjoy all animals, and that's something that I really do want to
do. Unit 5 is 10-8.
Sorry. Not a problem. That's something that I really do want to.
I love that.
We know that you're on the job. You got stuff you got to do.
I wasn't into birds until I had to take look at birds, and then I was like, okay, birds are pretty cool.
Yeah, I've recently followed on Instagram a couple birding accounts just because, you know, it's something that I think that a lot of people take for granted is the birds that are flying around. And so as I've talked to more rangers and, you know, been around the state parks more, I've really grown to have appreciation for birds. And, you know, I think I might try to start birding. Is that the proper word, birding?
Yeah, they call it birding. I would tell you just get one feeder and put in your yard, like in front of your living room or in front of your kitchen, somewhere you're going to see it quite a bit. And don't even just look at it all the time, but when you walk by and you glance and you're like, there's a bird. Because my husband was like, what is this bird? And it flew away, and then we had a time trying to figure out what it was, and now he really supports the birding from just seeing one stupid little bird.
I saw a couple ads for this bird feeder that actually has a camera on it, and you can put it, I know that's a little bit, that's a little high tech, and I don't know how much they run, but I'd like to get one of those, put that out there, and then maybe even start my own little, like, social media account of just all the different birds that come by the house or something. I think that'd be cool. Mm-hmm. So, Destiny, we couldn't end the Ranger Report without asking you about some of your sustainability that you have in the state parks. We know, we're very aware, we've done a couple episodes on our Go Green With Us initiative or program, and we know how intense all of our state parks feel about sustainability. You know, at TDEC, we are regulators, we are protectors of the environment. So not only do we talk the talk, we have got to walk the walk. So I wanted to talk to you a little bit about what Montgomery Bell is doing from a sustainability standpoint.
Yeah, so we have things for this kind of in a bunch of different areas. So one really big one is that we just installed back in June a porous pave walking trail in our ball field that's made out of like recycled tires. So we're really proud of that. We also now have 14 beehives when we started out with three. And this year we collected 431 jars of honey off of those hives. So that's something that we're really proud of and we're sharing with the community. Also with the community, we've started partnering with local businesses collecting aluminum. And we collected over 1,200 pounds of aluminum just from one business in Dixon County this year. So it's not a ton, but it's something we weren't doing before. We're reducing our mowed areas. We're reintroducing native pollinator plants to reduce mowing. And we're also changing out parking lots to solar as that comes available. As one goes out, when we replace it with solar. So we're doing a little things in a lot of different areas, and every now and then getting a pretty big project to try to be more sustainable.
Yeah, I know that there is a lot more funding than we have ever, you know, been used to with state parks coming down the pipeline. From Governor Lee has approved a lot of funding to go towards our state parks, which I think is so tremendous. And I'm excited to see what all of you guys in the state parks do with that. I think that's important. And I almost forgot, part of this episode, earlier in this episode, we were talking with one of our colleagues out of the Office of Energy Programs on electric vehicles in Tennessee. Now, he mentioned some of the charging stations being put in our state parks. So I wanted to ask you if you could talk about, do you guys have some charging stations at Montgomery Bell?
We do. We have two charging stations at the lodge at Montgomery Bell that are open to the public. And then we have one charging station at our park maintenance area that is just for us because we got a Ford Lightning this year. So that one is not open to the public and it shouldn't show up on any of those maps, but we do have two at the lodge.
That's neat. I mean, that's something that I didn't realize. Have you got to drive the Ford Lightning?
I did drive the Ford Lightning because initially we thought that I was going to be getting the Ford Lightning. So I drove it, and I really did like it. But with all the things that Rangers do, we didn't collectively as a group, we here on the park, we didn't think really that a Ranger should be in that vehicle. So we did leave that like in our maintenance department. Our facility supervisor took it.
That's really cool.
He seems to really enjoy it.
Yeah, I've only been able to see a couple of those. I've never been able to drive one, so. So yeah.
Oh, they're slick. They are quiet and they are smooth.
Yeah, I'm gonna have to. Maybe at one of these, I'm going to a sustainable transportation conference where they have like a ride and drive. So hopefully, I'll be able to drive one of those, test it out in the next couple months. But Destiny, so appreciative of all the stuff that you guys do. Thanks for you know, being there and being just such an advocate for not only our natural areas but also the history that is in those natural areas, especially there at Montgomery Bell State Park. Hopefully I'll get to come out there soon. My plan is to bring my daughter to all the state parks before she's one. So maybe as it starts to cool off a little bit, we'll make it out there. I'll hit you up and maybe you can show us around.
Yeah, big goals. I like it.
All right. Well, you have a great day and thanks for all you do.
Thanks. Y'all too.